Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and the forthcoming book, How to Raise Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're going to explore questions and some answers about body image, fat phobia, and diet culture. Joining us is Virginia Soul Smith, the author of The Eating Instinct, Food Culture, Body Image, and Guilt in America, and the forthcoming Fat Kid Phobia. Reporting on diet culture, health, and parenting has appeared in the New York Times, Scientific American, and many other publications. She also writes the newsletter Burnt Toast and hosts the Burnt Toast podcast. Virginia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Virginia, how did you go from being a writer of women's magazine diet stories to diet culture dismantler?
Well, it took a long time. It was probably about a 10 to 15 year process. I did start my career in women's magazines, and particularly my first job was at 17 Magazine. And one of my jobs there was to read the reader mail. This was in the early 2000s, pre-social media. So we got hundreds of emails every day from teenage girls. And it was really letter after letter of girls saying, you know, I hate that my best friend is thinner than me. I hate my stomach. I hate my thighs. Like really sad body image struggling stuff. And I would sort of take all these letters and be so enraged on their behalf. And, you know, what can we do for these girls? And the editors would say like, oh, don't worry. We're doing like how to get your best body for prom, or we're doing how to get a bikini body this summer. And that was the solution we were giving them, which felt incredibly wrong to me, because we were essentially saying to these girls, your fears are accurate. You should be trying to make yourself smaller. If you can do that, everything will be easier. But at this point in my career, I mean, I was brand new to the industry, still figuring out, you know, how to chart my way as a writer, and still also really in this diet culture trap. So it took many more years of writing articles where I was often sort of rationalizing to myself, like, this one isn't as bad as these other diet articles. You know, this one is, it's more of a lifestyle plan. You know, all the lines that we are used to the culture feeding us over and over, I was really in my head with all of that. And it didn't start to change until I became a mom. When my first daughter was born in 2013, Violet was born with a rare congenital heart defect. And as a result of that, she stopped eating when she was 1 month old. And suddenly, I was in this really strange situation where I had always thought of eating as something that, as long as you could follow a certain set of rules, you could do it right. Even more than that, I thought you could do it perfectly, and that my job as a mom would be to feed my child perfectly and to have this kind of, quote, perfect eater, and that this was what being a good mom meant. And suddenly, we were completely outside that paradigm. I mean, none of those rules applied to us. None of them were useful to us. And I had to help this little baby feel safe around food in a way that I realized I had never really felt safe around food. And so that was really, you know, I had been questioning over the years. I had been kind of dipping my toes in the waters of the anti-diet movement here and there. But that was really the point where I just thought, I have to throw the whole thing out. You know, this entire culture has been telling us that we can't trust our bodies, but I'm never going to help her do this if we can't figure out how to trust her body. So that was the big turning point.
So when you were going through this with Violet, it sounds like you had one foot still in diet culture, but then one foot in the anti-diet, health at every size movement. So how did helping Violet with her feeding process affect yours?
Well, it was really recognizing that, again, the instinct was to go and look for these external set of rules. Like I was almost looking for, I mean, the opposite of a diet, right? Because our goal was to get her to eat, not to get her to eat less.
Right.
But I was looking for someone else to tell me how we could do it and to find this plan. And there really wasn't a plan. I mean, pediatric feeding disorders are thankfully pretty rare, but they, you know, because of that, we don't have great research around them. We don't have great treatment paradigms. And especially, you know, this was 8 years ago. So before the current vogue for the responsive feeding model had really come together, you know, which is giving parents so many more options than we had. We were really on the front lines of that. And so, you know, the advice I was getting was just not working. And that made me realize how often I'd been given advice around eating that just did not work, did not achieve the results that I had been told to expect. And so that's really helped me kind of some of those questions and those moments of reckoning that had been happening over the years before started to just crystallize and make me realize that we had to really reject the paradigm that there is, quote, a right or perfect way to eat, and that there, we have to be following rules in order to do this well. And that led me to concepts like intuitive eating, or for kids, the division of responsibility feeding model. And, you know, those concepts really gave me a whole alternative framework, and where you really start from listening to your body and from valuing and respecting your body, which is the opposite of what diet culture teaches us. You know, so if I was going to start in a place with my daughter of her body has a lot of wisdom, her body has a lot it can tell us, even though not eating was, of course, a dangerous choice, there was a logic to it. She was doing it because she was in a traumatic situation and she was trying to protect herself. And when I could sort of respect that and really value that, it helped me just reframe the way I related to food completely. Because now it was like, well, I know I can trust my body. My body is starting from a place of knowing what's right. And I can sort of, you know, there's work to do unpacking these different choices that we make. And, you know, sort of looking at how we've arrived at the place we've arrived. But fundamentally, I can go back to I'm the expert on my body, not the diet industry. And that was a really powerful turning point.
Thank you for sharing your journey. And it makes me think of, you know, the difference between the control model, which would be the diet model, versus the trust model.
Yes, absolutely.
We have some questions today to ask you that are on the minds of a lot of people who are having a hard time navigating body image and navigating diet culture with themselves and with their friends and family, as well as with their kids and their teens. And I wanted to pose the first one to you. What do you do when you and your child are in sync, you know, in your home with non-diet and weight-inclusive approaches, but then you go out into the community, let's say, you know, you're at a restaurant and maybe the server or a family is there or a friend, and someone in the community projects their unsolicited feedback to your child about their weight. And let's assume that it's a higher weight comment.
They happen all the time, and these are the moments that are really unnerving to parents, because we want to protect our children from these toxic messages. But what I think is useful to consider is we're saying, like, we want to kind of shut out that noise and we want to keep our kids safe from those messages. Number one, that's not a realistic goal. They're going to be encountering these messages throughout the world. Number two, it's almost a little bit of that old diet mindset of wanting to create a perfect existence for our kids, you know, wanting to create this safe space where nothing goes wrong.
Right.
And we know that's not realistic. So what I tend to do instead is try to view those moments as opportunities to then later engage with my child and talk about what our values are and sort of reinforce our own thinking about these, rather than feeling like I have to protect my child from the experience. Now, I will say, if this is someone your child has regular contact with, like let's say it's grandma who babysits all the time, or, you know, an aunt who they're super close to and really look up to as a, you know, as a role model in a lot of other ways, then it might really be worth trying to talk to that person more directly and, you know, sharing some of your concerns and talking about different language you would hope they'd use. But if it's more of a one-off comment, you know, if it's you're at the hair salon and the hairdresser makes a comment that she's on whatever paleo diet or, you know, whatever it is, and you're just sort of like, this is something that's kind of passing through, you can consider, is it important for me to engage with this person, or is it more important for me to have a conversation with my kid later? And probably the only times I would engage directly with the person are if I need to advocate for my child. If it's a comment someone's making to your child about your child's body, you know, this happens at both ends of the spectrum at family meals when a kid's not eating the way a grandparent or another relative expects. I would definitely, and I have, jump in there and say, you know, we're trusting her body to do what it needs to do. We're not worried about her eating. She's learning new foods in her own time, and, you know, jump out in front of that. And I would do that for a kid in a larger body or a kid in a smaller body. It doesn't matter. Like, you advocate for your kid in that moment. But if it's someone making a comment about their own relationship with food, it would be more like a follow-up of, you know, gosh, I was really bummed out when granddad said he was, you know, not eating whatever food group again. Like, isn't that such a bummer that people feel like they can't eat that food, and sort of unpack it directly with my kid later.
And I think that makes sense. It's all relative, that if it's somebody is commenting about their own, whatever the latest fad wellness diet is, then that's one thing. And if it's a one-off But if it's something that is directly said to your child, and, you know, I think it's important to mention too, of course, we would advocate if it was a comment that was related to their body, let's say a higher weight comment. Also harmful would be making a comment about weight loss. You know, wow, it, you know, looks like you've lost weight. You look great, when your child maybe has just grown in height.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think any of that, you know, jumping in to say like, you know, her body's off limits, like we don't need to talk about her body, and just quickly moving it on, you know, like, or, but why don't you ask her how theater's going, you know, and help them redirect to a different topic, I think is really good. And the other thing too is then whatever damage that comment might do to your child, you've mitigated it because you've reminded them, I don't believe that. I don't, you know, that's not where we come from on this. So you've shown them that you don't take that comment seriously and that you will advocate for them. And then you're also helping them start to figure out how they'll advocate for themselves, which is our ultimate goal here.
And what about if your teen comes to you and they ask you the question, Mom, am I fat?
Well, you're going to give two answers. You're going to say yes or no, based on whether they are fat or not.
Okay.
And either way, if they are in a bigger body, you're going to say, yeah, you're fat, and that's a great way to be. But then you will also hold space for if they're feeling anxious about that. You might say, you know, why is that on your mind? Tell me what you're thinking about here, and do a little bit of unpacking. Maybe they've been being teased about their weight, or they have reasons that they're anxious about it. And then you can say to them really directly, you know, we live in a culture that is really unfair to people in larger bodies, and it's really wrong that you're having to experience this, and I'm here to support you. You know, what do you need? If your child's in a smaller body and this comes up, you want to get them to a sort of the same place but slightly different. You might say, no, you're not fat, but all bodies are great, and there's nothing wrong with being fat. So again, you're still going to reinforce that fat is not a bad way to be, even if they don't happen to be it. It's not something to fear or be anxious about. And then you also want to kind of get at, are they really doing that thing where they're using fat as a feeling and fat is not a feeling? You know, so what are the feelings underneath this? Like, what's bringing this up for them? So really, whatever your child's body size is, your end goal is the same. You want them to understand that being fat is not a bad thing. It's a great way to be. But we live in a culture that doesn't tell them that. The only difference is really the yes or no part based on what they really are. What you don't want to do is rush in and say, you're not fat, you're beautiful, because now you've put fat and beauty in opposition to one another. And if they are fat, you've lied to them. So that's sort of a double failure.
I just thought of this as you were talking about it, and I love the reframe from, no, honey, you're not fat, and the problem with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
What if when the teen comes to you and says, am I fat? And let's say that they, in fact, are fat. The reason that it's on their mind is that a friend, you know, that you know, that's in your home, that you're spending time with, has said that to them in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
Under what circumstances would you go back to the parent of that kid or not? What are your thoughts there?
It's going to be so case specific based on your relationship with that kid and also what your child wants you to do, you know?
Good point.
If we're talking about a teenager, maybe this is something they want to handle directly with their friend.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they do want your backup on it. So I would definitely start with, like, how can I support you? You know, that's so hurtful that she used fat in a negative way to you, you know, that she's talking about your body. I'm using she. Of course, it could be a he or a they or any pronoun. You could maybe talk with your teen about what would it look like to set a boundary and say, hey, I love you. You're such a good friend, but I don't want us to talk about our bodies. You know, I don't want us to get into body comparisons or any of that. That's not good for us. Both of our bodies are great. Like, could you help your team practice setting some boundaries there? That might be great. If that's not something your kid's comfortable with, and, you know, and maybe you know the other parent well, and this is like a family that you're close with, you could say, hey, you know, do you want me to talk to them? But I would not do that without your child's permission, just because I think that they're at a stage in the teenagers where they do want to start practicing some of these tools, and you coming in to protect them in that way might feel really like too much. You know, it just might not
land. I totally agree. I totally agree. And I think it would be such a normal urge to have as a parent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it reminds me of the urge to really want to protect them from anything bad happening, when in reality, that's not going to help them learn how to navigate challenging situations.
Right. And whereas in the first question, we were talking about, you know, what if it's another adult making a comment? I think it is appropriate for you to to advocate for your child at the pediatrician's office
totally.
Or with an older family member or with a coach or something like that. When it's a peer-to-peer thing, I think there's more opportunity there for them to practice their own advocacy skills. Again, with your support, maybe with you helping practice some conversations, do some role-playing, whatever. But that's where kids kind of need to be using these tools themselves versus a parent swooping in to navigate that with them.
And I like the idea of sort of practicing the boundary that you could say, that they could maybe say to their teen friend, just even kind of having the knowledge and talking about the skill set and practicing it, even if they don't feel comfortable saying it, could be good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they may not have that conversation with this friend, but it may help them, you know, even take a step back from the friendship in a way that's useful.
And Virginia, I love in your book, The Eating Instinct, how you talked about you and I growing up in a time in the 80s and the 90s. Those were our formative teen years. And at that time, dieting was so much more straightforward. And now a lot of times when we have, you know, acquaintances that are talking about their food, they'll oftentimes talk about the latest wellness fad, but under the guise of health. Can we define diet? It's not as straightforward as it used to be. What is a great definition of a diet?
Well, a diet is any kind of attempt to control your eating with the intention of weight loss. Now, we should sidebar that, of course, there are medically prescribed diets. For example, when my daughter was recovering from heart surgery, there was a period of time when she couldn't eat fat in her diet. That was nothing to do with weight. You know, everyone wanted her to gain weight, but it was necessary because of medical complications. So there are sort of medically prescribed diets that are not about weight loss.
Okay.
But those are pretty unusual, to be honest. What we see much more, especially as diet culture has morphed into wellness culture, is we see diets that don't even call themselves diet. They call themselves lifestyle plans or cleanses or reboots or, you know, they may even say, oh, no, this is about health. I just got a press release for one where they said, you know, we know you're triggered by the word cleanse, but it's not that kind of cleanse. And then I looked and it was a very small amount of daily calories and you weren't allowed to eat like six major food groups. And I was like, really, it's the same thing, guys.
Right.
So anytime we're cutting out lots of food groups, we're counting, tracking things, we're manipulating how we eat with an end goal stated overtly or more, you know, below the radar with an end goal of making our bodies smaller, that is a diet. And we know that diets are, number one, ineffective. People will lose some weight in the short term, but they will not sustain the weight loss long term, and they will usually gain back more than they lost. And number two, we know they're really damaging. They create a disordered relationship with food where you aren't able to sort of listen to your hunger and fullness cues and trust your body. You're in this really sort of external place with food, feeling bad if you can't live up to the diet's rules, feeling like you have to constantly be vigilant about what you're eating so you can't just enjoy meals with people anymore. And for teenagers in particular, of course, dieting is incredibly dangerous. We know that childhood dieting is the number one predictor of future eating disorder risk. So that's what a diet is and why it's not a great idea.
Those are great definitions of a diet. And so if your teen comes home and talks all about their friend's diet, what might you say to your teen?
Right. So this is a little bit like when your teen's friend has a boyfriend or romantic interest that you're not excited about. Like, or if your teen does, like, you're not going to get anywhere by criticizing the friend, right? That's only going to sort of pit you against the friend and then against your own child. So instead, I would say something like, oh, I'm really bummed to hear they feel like they need to make themselves smaller. You know, that is such a dangerous message. We hear it all the time, but it's just not true. So I wouldn't make it about your friend is doing something bad or your friend is bad for doing it, but just like, you know, I'm bummed out that I'm seeing them do this because I want better for them and I want better for you. And I think then you're leaving some space for like, you know, what do you think's going on with them? Why do you think they're pursuing this? And also, how does it make you feel to hear them talking about this? So it's much less judgment and labeling and much more being curious and giving your kid a chance to talk about what it's bringing up for them to see their friend on a diet. Does it make them think maybe it's something they should be doing? Does it make them worried about their friend? And then again, you can get into more opportunities for role-playing, practicing how to navigate that conversation. Your child is certainly allowed to set that boundary with this friend. Like, you know what? Diet talk is so boring. I'm just so sick of talking about what we eat. Like, can we talk about something else? You know, and you can help your kid practice how to navigate away from that. So, you know, it's really important, especially when we're talking about a teenager on a diet. We don't want this kid to feel bad about this. This is not this kid's fault. This is our culture telling this kid that this is something they need to do to feel safe in the world. And this is a failure of all the adults around them that this child doesn't feel safe in their body. So definitely don't blame the kid. Make it much more about, you know, what's really going on here.
Virginia, how would you explain fat phobia?
I mean, you can say we live in a culture that treats people differently based on their body size. Mm-hmm. And when we see negative messages about people in bigger bodies, this is called fat phobia or anti-fat bias. You know, you can use whatever term feels comfortable to you. It's wrong. It's something we need to fight to change, just like we're fighting to change racism and homophobia and other forms of bigotry. I think helping kids understand weight stigma and fat phobia in the same conversation as other kinds of biases is really important, because it takes it a little bit off this sort of personal project of body image and body love, which, not that that's not valuable, it is, but it helps them understand that, oh, you know, this is something I need to do to help make the world a better place. Like, this is about a whole larger framework of oppression that I can help fight against. And so then that gives them a little bit of a larger purpose around it. And it's also true. And then the other thing I think is important to do is, once you've kind of laid some groundwork and talked about what fat phobia is, point it out when you see it. Call it out. You know, I've forgotten that, you know, you're watching Friends reruns, and you can say, you know, I've forgotten, man, like, old episodes of Friends are so fat phobic. Like, why do they keep putting Monica in the fat suit and shaming her for having been big in high school? Like, this is so depressing. There's nothing wrong with being fat. And unfortunately, pop culture is going to give you so many opportunities to call it out. But that's helpful, because, again, we're not trying to keep these kids in a bubble where this doesn't happen. We're trying to empower them to fight it. So now they're seeing it, and they're able to kind of start pushing again. You know, your kid will start calling it out to you, which is a great moment. And, you know, they'll start changing how they talk about it with their friends.
And you're so right. I hadn't even thought of that. In the beginning of the pandemic, my daughter and I were watching Iron Man for the first time. For whatever reason, we're really far behind on that one.
I am too.
We've done enough of talking about becoming critical viewers of the media. And my daughter actually pointed out, she's like, wait a second, it's this scene where all these dancers are on stage. And she's like, what is happening? Why are all of these women on the stage white? Why are they thin? And I'm like, how interesting. She's really taking it in.
I even had a moment with my, you know, she's only eight, but my eight-year-old is reading the Harry Potter books right now. And she called out to me, oh, Mom, you're going to hate this in book four. They have Dudley on a diet. It's not okay.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It is a pretty cool moment. You know, it makes me think pop culture is such an obvious way, unfortunately. I think it's getting a little bit better each year. You know, there are some really great TV shows, like Shrill is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, over the holidays, we were watching Just Friends. Have you ever seen Just Friends?
I have not seen Just Friends.
Not that I'm recommending it to the listeners. It's very funny, but there is a fat-phobic theme. So Ryan Reynolds is the lead, and it's this sort of this timeline when he's in high school. He's put in the friend zone, quote unquote, by his best friend at the time. He is wearing a fat suit, and then later on, years later, comes back into town, and now he's in a smaller body, and suddenly he's no longer in the friend zone.
Hollywood just needs to get rid of the fat suit. They were always horrible, and it's either an opportunity for, like, really lazy fat phobic jokes, or it's a missed opportunity to give a role to a fat actor. You know, I mean, to give why Renee Zellweger doesn't need to be in a fat suit? We can find someone to play that part who's going to do a brilliant job.
Are there any shows that are doing a better job?
So shows is really hard. I do love Shrill, which you already mentioned, based on the book by Lindy West. It's terrific. Another movie I saw recently and loved and really, like, kind of moved me to tears was Can You Ever Forgive Me?, which stars Melissa McCarthy as the writer Lee Israel, who was actually a writer back in the, like, early 90s who became a con artist and forged all these letters by famous writers because she couldn't actually sell her own work. And so what's amazing about Can You Ever Forgive Me? Is Lee Israel is not a good person. She's not a great character. She's drinking a lot. She's committing crimes. She's, like, incredibly flawed. And she is in a fat body, and that's not a plot point at all. Nice. She's allowed to be a fully realized, complicated, flawed person carrying a movie, doing a brilliant performance by Melissa McCarthy. And her weight, you know, it's just a fact about her. It's just a neutral fact. And it was one of the first times I could remember seeing that where, because even Shrill, as great as it is, the whole first season is about her coming to terms with her weight and accepting her body. You know, yes. I mean, it is about that experience.
It is, right.
So that's, like, to me, the next frontier of what we need is not just content where there's fat protagonists learning to love their bodies and fighting back against stigma, but fat protagonists where that's the least interesting thing about them. It's just, you know, they're allowed to be fully formed people in the world.
Virginia, is there anything you're creating right now that you're excited about?
Well, professionally, I'm spending most of my time on my newsletter, Burnt Toast, and my podcast, which is also called Burnt Toast. And I have to say, these are jobs I have loved more than probably any other job. It's every week I get to write about challenging diet culture and fat phobia in different ways, and it's super exciting. So that's, you know, professionally, like, I feel really good about that work that I'm doing, which is nice, especially, as I mentioned, after undoing all those years of women's magazine diet damage that I did. Personally creating, well, it's winter here in the Hudson Valley, so we're buried under snow and ice, but I'm starting to plan my garden for next summer, which I have to do this time of year in order to, like, hold out hope that the sun will ever return. And it's, like, a really satisfying creative process for me, so that's been a lot of fun, too.
And how would people find or subscribe to Burnt Toast, both the newsletter and the podcast?
So the podcast is anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search Burnt Toast or my name, Virginia Soul Smith. And the newsletter is virginiasoulsmith.substack.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram, and that's @V_SoulSmith.
Virginia, thank you for, you know, being here today and for sharing your journey with us and your expertise in answering these really tough questions, and also for encouraging independent anti-diet journalism.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you have any questions, you can shoot me a note at www.signadarkening.com. See you next time.